Hello, I'm Rosemary Martirana, Director of Intelligence here at the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, NJOHSP, and you're listening to Intelligence Unclassified. This podcast is exactly what the title states, unclassified information about current trends in homeland security for the state of New Jersey, as well as educational information and resources for your awareness. Although it is produced every month, we aim to stay on top of current events and will often offer additional content. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow NJOHSP on Twitter at NJOHSP and Facebook. All links can be found in the show note and on our website, www.njohsp.gov. The events of 2015 highlight that New Jersey and the United States face a terrorist landscape more dangerous than any since the attacks of September 11th in 2001. From the brutal and tragic attacks in San Bernardino and Paris, the year saw a dramatic rise in multi-operative, small-scale attacks on civilian soft targets, all with little to no warning, as well as the decentralization and diffusion of the global terrorism movement. This new dynamic makes it extremely difficult for law enforcement and homeland security professionals at all levels of government to detect and deter attacks like San Bernardino, Paris, Philadelphia, or Boston. Now more than ever, state and local coordination is critical to combating the evolving and diffuse terrorist threat we face. Homeland security has become hometown security, and OHSP is working diligently with our partners to stay abreast of terrorist capabilities. This three-part series was adopted from a webinar our office hosted in January and is intended to expand on some of the themes presented in NJOHSP's 2016 threat assessment, which is available on our website at www.njohsp.gov. Episode 1 discusses the increase in competition between the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, and Al-Qaeda that we expect to see in 2016. Episode 2 takes a hard look at domestic extremism throughout the United States, while the third episode explores the concept of blended extremism, or individuals that draw their inspiration from multiple radical ideologies and tailor these beliefs to ultimately form a unique worldview to advance their violent goals. You may recognize the voices of our Analysis Bureau Chief, Dean Barada, and our Deputy Bureau Chief, Kim Brown, in this podcast, who were featured in our HVE speaker series. But before I turn the mic over to them, thank you for your continued support to the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness.
That takes us to the third trend that we find really interesting. We noticed it, I think, about a year and a half ago, and that is something that we are coining as blended extremists. And what we've noticed is that, particularly when we're talking about homegrown violent extremists, these sort of individual attackers, they are not ideologically pure. And so the terrorists that we may remember from the days of old, the 70s, the 80s, even a little bit into the 90s, when you would join a terrorist group or swear affiliation to a terrorist group, Hezbollah, Hamas, something like that, the Red Army faction, you would buy into their entire political program. Sort of like joining them involved, it was like joining an organization or joining an army. You had to sort of adopt that entire platform. What we're seeing now is people taking a much more sort of cafeteria approach to ideology. I like a little bit of this, I like a little bit of that. And that makes things difficult for us for a couple of reasons. One, everybody likes to see people sort of put in a box, a clear box. Oh, this is an ISIS-inspired terrorist. This is a Al-Shabaab-inspired terrorist. But when you have this sort of mix of ideologies, it gets much more messy. It gets a lot harder to do. So that's the first problem, just in terms of sort of cataloging them. But the second is it makes trying to anticipate their actions much more difficult. We know, for example, what ISIS's intent is, targeting intent. They're very clear of who they think are sort of their, you know, their top 10 most wanted list. But when you throw into the mix some other ideology, like New Black Panther Party or this, well, now it gets a lot more muddled and maybe their targeting is going to be different. So we got three examples here that we'll quickly talk about. You want to start?
Just to take it back for a little bit. So how this blended extremism came about was the Alton Nolan case. Mm-hmm. And so after the incident where this individual in Oklahoma, he beheaded one of his coworkers. And after looking at his Facebook, we saw a blending of some Black Hebrew Israelite as well as some Islamic propaganda. So when we briefed it on our webinar shortly after the incident, we described it as a hodgepodge. And so we couldn't couldn't continue with the word hodgepodge, even though we like it. You know, we came up with blended extremism, but I think it actually does give you a good idea of, you know, what we're describing. So individuals that are taking bits and pieces and fitting it into their own belief system. So the first incident or example that we have is that of Zale Thompson, the New York hatchet attack back in October 2014. So Zale, he attended several New Black Panther Party meetings in response to what he perceived as violence from law enforcement. And I believe he also had a number, or he was self-radicalized himself by looking at a number of ISIS beheading videos. So taking those two ideologies and blending them together, you know, the October 23rd incident happened.
So the next one is the Garland, Texas shooting attacks. You may remember there was a Draw Muhammad contest there, and two guys showed up armed, and they were killed before they could do any serious harm. But they were inspired by a mix of ISIS and Al-Shabaab operatives and sympathizers online. And so it doesn't appear they were directed. Nobody said, go to this event and, you know, take these guns and at 6 o'clock do this. But rather, they were getting that sort of inspiring, motivating talk. You know, hey, you've got to do something. Your brothers overseas are getting killed every day. It's time to take a stand for the religion. So there was that sort of blending going on. And again, here, this is where, very interesting, at the local level, you don't see that organizational competition really having an impact because Al-Shabaab is an Al-Qaeda affiliate. So yet again, two groups that in other parts of the world are in open combat on the ground here in the U.S., I'll take a little bit of this, I'll take a little bit of that, it's all good. And they don't really make those distinctions. And then in Oregon, we've seen some interesting things. Probably unsurprising to see, let's say, militias and sovereigns mixing because they are sort of from the same family tree. So, they're kind of like first cousins, if you want. So it wouldn't be unusual to see similarities there. We did see some interesting things. There's some white nationalism, white supremacy in there, although that's not the driving force of it. We did see there was one gentleman in the compound who was a little bit militia. He was a little bit white supremacist, and we knew he was white supremacist because he was praising ISIS because he was convinced that ISIS was going to destroy Israel and the Jews. Yes. So you have that on an individual level, you have some blending. But what I think what you're going to see there is you have so many ideologies in a tight space. I'm calling this, Kim rolls her eyes every time I say this, but I call this sort of the petri dish of blending extremism. You're going to have militia members, sovereigns, other anti-government extremists, white supremacists. They're going to be in a tight place on a tight period of time, they're going to exchange views. And when they all go back to their homes, they're going to take a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and we'll probably see some sort of evolution in these groups and these ideologies moving forward. So I think that's something we can expect.
Yeah, so it might become common to see maybe a white supremacist sending out sovereign citizen literature or using the terminology to, you know, get out of court or, you know, whatever it is. And so, again, it will be very hard to look at the indicators and, you know, put these people in a box because, again, they're pulling from different ideologies, making it very hard for the analysts and for law enforcement to identify.
And a great example of how this makes it difficult is the San Bernardino attack that just happened in December. So there, reports are that at least the husband was radicalized and considering an attack several years prior, motivated, I believe, by Al-Qaeda ideology. But did any of that have anything to do with their targeting of, you know, that county office building? Or was that a mix of personal grievance and some other events? You know, we're still sort of figuring that out now. But that's what makes this muddied sort of mess. No longer can some, I shouldn't say no longer, it's getting increasingly rare where some sort of corporate HQ is issuing a targeting guidelines and everyone else just follows that order and goes, oh, we're all going to build an X to conduct an attack or a hijacking of airline B. Instead, we're seeing a lot of sort of encouragement, people sort of taking their own initiative, and you're just seeing that mixture of personal grievance and ideology together, and they can concoct their own targeting list. So that makes things very, very difficult for us.
Yeah, I think when someone's upset or angered by a certain situation, whether it be a personal grievance or events that are taking place, and they're looking for an outlet or someone to vent to, and they find, you know, ISIS propaganda, or they're finding some Al-Qaeda, something online. So it's those different venues that they're looking at to find inspiration to do something. So again, it'll be multiple groups or ideologies that they'll pull their inspiration from. Again, making it a lot harder for us to identify these individuals.
So with blended extremism, honestly, we're still working with this definition and trying to define it. And I think we're going to have a lot of trouble doing that because it is a very nebulous concept. But what sparked us to think about this was very much individual cases. I don't know if we've seen it institutionalized yet. Yes, I guess I have to leave it there. I don't know if I've seen it institutionalized yet, but I don't think it's impossible to see that. We have a lot more thinking and talking and writing to do on this subject before it's solidified and we can say a ton about it.
So, Dean, following our last episode for the threat assessment series, you briefly touched on the concept of blended extremism. Let's go into that in a little more detail. Do we anticipate seeing more blended extremists in the future?
I think so. And I think that one of the best ways to think about blended extremism is if you look at sort of the terrorism model of, let's say, the 1960s, 70s, 80s, you had some formal structures and you kind of needed to have those. If you wanted to coordinate with people, you didn't have access to the technical means we have today where you could sort of instant message, Skype conversation with somebody across the world instantaneously. It wasn't easy to do. So you needed formal structures. You needed organizations. We've seen that change, and increasingly we're seeing people take these sorts of almost approach extremism in a buffet or a cafeteria style, where they can take a little bit of this ideology, a little bit of that one, and they wrap that up with their own sort of personal grievances or goals. And you just don't need to have that tight connection to an organization with a formal manifesto like you did 30, 40, 60 years ago. So I think we will increasingly see that as it becomes easier and easier to make your individual ideology known and access other ideologies, you're going to see more and more of people sort of incorporating what they like and leaving aside what they don't.
So Homeland Security professionals, we often try and lump people into buckets or categories. Obviously, this concept of blended extremism is going to make that hard for us to do that. How do we account or adjust for that then?
So this is something that kind of drives us crazy. And it really is just a problem, I think, for researchers and analysts who look at this. I don't think anybody else really cares too much. But there are sort of important implications for that. If you take someone, for example, who is inspired a little bit by ISIS, a little bit by AQ, a little bit by a domestic terrorist extremist, and you just sort of lump them in the ISIS column, that is not accurate, and it's a problem for a couple reasons. First, it makes, for example, in this example, it makes ISIS look bigger than they are. It then also sort of de-emphasizes the impact of these other ideologies that they draw on. And so you're not really getting an accurate threat picture out there. So at some point, using the old sort of bin system where everybody can only fall into one ideological bin is problematic. And if this trend sort of increases, assessments of threat are going to be less and less tied to reality. So our first step in trying to figure out how to sort of deal with this is recognizing that it exists, recognizing that people are going to sort of create new ideologies. We're working through that right now. We don't have all the answers, but we think this is a good first step.
Great. Thanks, Dean. And remember, stay safe and Jersey strong.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.